Okay, we're on page 150. 150 in the last chapter. Before I start, when I was going through this section again, I came across where Elder Simeon talks about, actually it's further on, where he talks about another book that he wrote, which of course is only in Greek. It's called All Things Work for Good. You'll run into where he mentions it. So I looked it up to see if there was anything of that book available anywhere online, and I did find a brief section from that book, which includes the point that he was referring to in this book. And I thought that this is a really nice thing to point out, the point that he makes here, because we're reading this book, and Sharon was critical of it for a particular reason that she mentioned, that it's all about psychology, that it's not... Well, this speaks to that, this little section from this other book. I don't know how you take things, Archimandrite Simeon says, but it is of very great importance that one sees everything within the providence of God, his whole self, the conditions in which he finds himself, and everything that happens around and inside him. Everything is within the providence of God, and everything works for the good alone. Psychologists and psychiatrists operate merely on a human level, but this mere human level doesn't have a great value. Within the church, everything happens according to the providence of God, the purpose of which is for man to finally give himself to God. The psychologist or the psychiatrist usually operate in one way, so that whatever they do with a person, they do for a person in order to raise them up. Certainly, a psychologist is able, in a human way, to help regulate someone who has an imbalance within and can help him to live just as others live in the world. This, however, does not mean at all that this person was helped in giving himself up to God. And yet, the heart of the matter centers on man giving himself to God and not simply remaining at the human level. When someone understands how things are and works on himself properly, little by little, the hidden states in the subconscious and in the unconscious begin to emerge from out of his very being, which is an abyss. And if the life-giving experiences which are found deep within are unhealthy, are pathological, then the person is led by and acts in accordance with these experiences. He does very badly and can't understand what is happening to him. But even when the experiences which are hidden inside of him are not very burdensome, the person still doesn't control them, and they act in an autonomous way. That is, they act in a self-governing way, and they control us, autonomous in that these things, these experiences act inside of us as though they had a life of their own. Passions are like that. Other things, you can go a little further into depth on that than we want to right here. A person can only control things that are conscious. So if these things are acting within us at an unconscious or subconscious level, we can't control them. A person can only control things that are conscious, since he sees only in his being that which is conscious. You remember at the beginning of the book, we talked about how the fathers are always concerned to try to bring everything up to the level of consciousness so that we can deal with them. Man is called to say, "Today I will do this brave thing. I will give my whole self to God. I will surrender myself to God." Yes, but what do you give over? Only that which you control. Today, when you give yourself over honestly, honorably, you give over your conscience. But already by tomorrow, you feel the need to do it again, exactly because one part of your subconscious came out and became conscious. So there's always more coming up to be dealt with. In any case, we must know that the experiences of the subconscious, which, as it was said, can also be unhealthy, are not permitted by the person to emerge. He fears them. But if he has courage to allow them to come out and gives himself over as he is to God, salvation begins. And then, of course, it begins and it continues. The next day, more. The following time, more. Until the whole subconscious comes out. The whole unconscious comes to the surface. And in this way, he gives his whole self to God. This is how someone becomes a man of God, becomes a Christian. And I thought that put things into good perspective. And that's another book that is only in Greek. Like the other three books that are like this one, only in Greek. I'm still making it. Still, I need to go back and do some more work collecting the things that have been translated, brief sermons that have been translated for most days of the church year. Okay. Page 150. Now, we really did get to 151 because we went a little further into this next section, just a page and a half. But in order to have continuity, I want to go back to 150 and start like this. About four lines down in the last section, under the title, "Why Does the Person Bind Himself So Closely to the Idealized Image?" Many good Christians who are attached to this idealized image manage to appear balanced, calm, superior, and in this way they have demands and claims on others in life, as if they were superior. Somebody asked last week, what does it mean such a person has claims on others? Because they are presenting themselves to others as good Christians, balanced, calm, and even superior. And so they're in a position to be able to feel like they have a claim on others, and others acknowledge it on the basis of the way they conduct themselves. But as soon as something, an incident, some event, undermines this idealized image, since it's imaginary, fictitious, and not real, one is compelled to see his real self. And I'm jumping down five lines. To see his shortcomings, to see the conflicts and all the confusion that exists inside him, down a couple lines. It is something very important for the person to see after an event, after a shocking occurrence, that he isn't who he thought he was, and to see himself in such a way that he can no longer stand to live. It is something, because the point is to have this idealized self-image die. It is something very important for the person to feel that it's a good thing for a person to find himself in such a situation. It's an opportunity for him to stop living with his imaginary, fictitious self, to make a decision to come down to earth and begin his life from the beginning. And from that point on, similar to what we just heard in this other section, from that point on, begin to live salvation. Begin to, from that point on, to live with his real self, to see his real self, and to move with it toward God. And this self, real self, what is it like? You know, if this were a secular book, the idea would be that there is a real self that is much more magnificent that you're just not living up to. And it's, that's not the understanding here. The understanding here is, what is this real self like? It is in relationship to God, first of all, and that means that we recognize that we are dependent on God, that we are created, he is created creatures, and that the only possibility, by comparison with God, is humility and a shame that we've ever built ourselves up into identifying with this fictitious self-image. That's our real self. It's not like there's a hidden magnificent self, my real self that I never want to betray. We don't want to betray our real self, but the real self is only revealed when we see ourselves as we actually are in relationship to God. And then, once we see that, we will recognize that humility is the only appropriate response. Okay, to live with his real self, to live as we actually are, to see his real self and to move with it toward God. So there's the fourth direction, you might say. Could move toward others, trying to establish ourselves. Toward others, against others, away from others. One other possibility. All that goes away. We have a realistic recognition of how we actually are, and we move with this recognition in the fourth direction, toward God. That's, you could even call it, I think, a fourth direction. To seek God, to seek holiness, to seek perfection, his perfection, which comes from humility, not because of our accomplishment. But it is very difficult for this to happen. Very difficult. He's starting to move toward a final theme in the book, which he really starts to nail down beginning on the next page, 152. As difficult as it is for someone to jump from an airplane into the void, some people go up in an airplane, jump out of a perfectly good airplane with a parachute first time, very difficult because, after all, the thing doesn't even open up until you're descending down through the air. If you don't pull the cord, you're dead. So it's difficult until you've had the confidence of jumping many times. As difficult as it is for someone to jump from an airplane into the void, it is even more difficult for him to let himself go and jump into this void that is created in his existence as his idealized image departs from inside him. Very difficult. That's the kind of difficulty he's talking about. Second sentence under the next heading. We shouldn't be surprised at all when we see a person being, as we say, hard-headed and not being able to understand something, not being able to change his opinion about something. Remember, we can only understand those things that fit in with our way of understanding, looking at the world, which is based on our filter, that is our idealized image. That's how we see the world. Shall we say something else now? Do you think it'll be too much? I don't imagine it is too much. Someone can go all the way to death when it's a question of saving his idealized image. That is why some people reach the point of suicide. And I can't help but think of a particular person here who did take his own life. And everything that the elder is saying here just completely fits. At least in this way, four lines down, at least in this way, he departs with the conviction that he's something. It's the last act of control for this kind of person. He departs with his superiority. He departs being identified with the idealized image he has. He's taken his own life in order to preserve, he goes to that length to preserve this identification with a fictitious image of himself that he has. A man that is in control and refuses to be dealt with unfairly by life. You know, somebody in particular in mind, nobody here knows, in fact. However, it does sometimes happen at some point when the facts force a person to abandon his idealized image. At that point, some people find their real self. Some manage to return to the idealized image, while others suffer psychologically, and God knows what will become of them. The person, top of 153, who is bound up in this way with the idealized image is as if he has a building, a house, that he feels is supported very well. It's as if it is built on a good foundation. That's the person's sense. And yet this house is full of dynamite, which can blow up at any moment and blast the house into the air. That's why such a person, peaceful, calm, humble, in quotation marks, important, not only in his own eyes, but unfortunately others sometimes see him that way too, and that gives him a claim on others, right? Doesn't accept objections, doesn't accept criticisms, doesn't agree to change his mind. So he's in control, all based on this fictitious self-image, which other people even accept to a certain degree. This is the person who can't bear it when people don't recognize him. He can't stand it when people don't admire him. He can't stand to lay himself open to criticism, to appear to have fallen into error, to appear to be like everybody else. What relaxes him, what supports him, is for him to think and for others to think that he stands extremely high. This person can't live without others' admiration, without their flattery. He is very dependent on others, very much bound up with others, despite the fact that he appears to be isolated. The next section is about how sometimes we project our idealized image on others, and things can get very confused that way. The example that Elder Saman uses on the next page on 154 is the example of a spiritual son projecting his idealized image onto his spiritual father. And as a consequence, he doesn't see him as he is, but as his idealized image has fashioned him inside of himself. This happens, I think, too, in romantic love when we're very young. Projection of our idealized image on the other person. So it's actually narcissism. It's actually self-love, where we project an image of ourselves onto a young lady, or vice versa, can work either way, and that is the love that's going on. It's actually a kind of self-love that happens also. It's closely related to this, I think. And so, attachment to the spiritual father manifests itself. There are other kinds of projection. I don't want to spend a lot of time in this because we're really deep into the psychological aspect of things here. Okay, projection. Sometimes people will project something on us and be angry with us because there is something going on inside of themselves and we're kind of just the most appropriate person to project it on. Like, well, one of my first shocks in being a priest was when a member of the parish council, I don't know if he was a member of the council at first, eventually he was a member of the council and then warden and were all kinds of problems. But he introduced himself to me when I first got to my first parish by telling me, "Father, it's nothing personal, I hate priests. I just hate priests and I thought I should let you know that." You know, just that was my introduction to this fellow. Things went downhill after that. Projection. Now, this man had reasons for being angry at God. Who is more appropriate, appropriately available, if you're angry against God, than a priest? And so that's what this fellow did. You know, that's what he did with priests. So, well, we had an interesting relationship. You know, it was an interesting relationship. It wasn't all bad. It was probably maybe 75% bad, maybe 80, you know, but that 20% was important. And I still have a kind of cringing affection for this fellow, honestly, and, you know, and respect as well. What's that?
What did you say?
Cringing.
Kind
of cringy.
Cringing affection.
Cringing.
So that's another case, another example of projection. Sometimes when we feel like we're being just, dramatically unfairly dealt with, it's possible that there is projection going on, you know. And Elder Saman makes some remarks coming up that fit into that category as well. But I don't want to spend a lot of time in this section. I want to go over to page 155 after the new heading. We find ourselves in danger if we don't pay attention. Second paragraph, second line. Christian life isn't fun and games. God is great, and he's ready to help man. There's no room for any doubt. Salvation is given for free, and it is extremely easy. It is extremely easy once we've given up trying to save ourselves. But from this aspect, however, the person gets things mixed up and seeks salvation elsewhere, since deep inside resides the ego, selfishness, this love of ourselves which began the day that the first created fell. The first created stopped looking to God and began looking to themselves, turned toward themselves, and all the dreadful things began from that point on and reach all the way to today. And while we're baptized and we should be living differently, somehow in the end we don't manage to live in a genuinely Christian way, but instead we live erroneously, missing the mark. Perhaps also the period, the times we live in, favor such unhealthy situations. Let's pray that what we're saying will help us a little, so that this year, 2017, the idealized image we have inside us may finally be crucified. So it's, you know, it's not so bad once you realize that you're not being asked to crucify yourself. You're being asked to crucify a made-up, fictitious, false image of yourself. So that's kind of comforting, except it still hurts. It hurts a lot. Let's get our ego crucified. We're all on board there, right? Together with Christ, of course, and our self resurrected together with the Lord. Our humble self standing before God, not moving toward or against or away from others, but only toward Him. Okay, that's enough of an introduction for this week. We all on the same page? Is it not connecting at all with our experience? Or, you know, Sherry, when she was here last time and, you know, asked, how do I know if I have an idealized self-image? The thing that I thought of, I didn't respond to this at the time, but the thing that I've thought of is this, that in a previous book, in the, what was it called?
Layman in the Desert.
I think in Layman in the Desert, probably also in a previous book even further back, there's probably the Deep Ender book. There's a story about the monk who goes out with the other monk to the cemetery and starts berating and saying terrible, awful things to a monk who has died and buried. And what is the response of the monk? Nothing. You know, and he starts praising him, you know, and what is the response of the monk? Nothing. No response at all. If we do that, then we know we have no idealized self-image. If you respond as though you were dead, which is our advice, if we can reach the point that we respond to praise or to being berated by others, to be not being treated with sufficient respect, and we have no reaction at all, then we have no idealized self-image. So if that is our condition, we can rest assured we are on the road to salvation. We just kind of keep going in that direction, and it's easy after that.
Well, in my experience, there are plenty of opportunities that people will give us to find out that we're not, or that we are.
We all pretty much have an idealized self-image. And most of the book is about going into details about different ways of having an idealized self-image, different relationships that we can have to the idealized self-image. Someone thinks that's who they really are. You know, and another person thinks that's the way they should be, that's the real them, and then they look at themselves the way they see they are in the world, and they feel worse than they actually are by comparison with this fictionalized idea of how they ought to be. And Elder Simeon mentions that some of that idealized self-image comes from the society around us. So that's really the way young ladies, you know, who see fashion models and the movie stars and all of the rest of that nonsense and all of the fictitious idea of what the ideal woman is like, who deserves to be treated as though they are really absolutely perfectly beautiful. And young women have that kind of relationship with their idealized self-image. And no matter how beautiful they may be, they always fall short because they're comparing themselves to an idealized self-image. And it works with men too in the same kind of way. You know, in just any kind of self-image that you can imagine. And, you know, as we mentioned some sessions back, our society is in the business of producing all of the appropriate paraphernalia and accoutrements that are necessary and useful for building up virtually any kind of idealized self-image that you can imagine. We can all have one that is completely different. And those idealized self-images may make absolutely no sense to other people. And then people kind of glom together who have similar idealized self-images, and they carry signs and they dump on other people. And you can go out to the local, you know, idealized self-image store of that particular type and get all the things that you need. It makes money, and everybody's happy, and everybody feels individualistic, and of course inside other people don't treat us as well as we ought to be treated, and there ought to be a special law to make other people treat, all that kind of stuff. It all has to do with idealized self-images.
Love is directly, you go to a Harley place, and you can buy all the leather and all the appropriate bandanas and skulls and all the things you need to give you a certain, look.
Yeah.
grow your beard the right way.
And most of these guys are over 50 these days.
Oh, yeah, they're the ones
I was in high school, it was James Dean. I mean, he was good looking, you know. He was a young fellow, you know. But now there are all these old geezers out there with all this leather and big beards.
And guts.
You know, and who knows what's in their head, you know. What's that?
And fat guts. And
absolutely, it's almost like part of the image now, you know. I don't care, you know. Whatever. So we got one for you. It's going to be expensive, but we got your idealized self-image for you.
That is interesting. Yeah.
Next section, 157. The idealized image must die. Okay, he's finally just left us have it. This is it. Now that he's got all of us. If the idealized image within us doesn't die, there's no point in talking about the cross, about Christ's passion. There's no point in believing that we're celebrating Holy Week, the crucifixion, the resurrection of Christ, because within us lives a wild beast which ought to and should die. I do think it's really helpful to realize that it's not, because we call it the old Adam and things like that, you know, we kind of, but it's the idealized self-image. That's what needs to die. It's not like, well, I have a self, I kind of really like it. You want me to kill it so that I can let that go for the sake of some kind of vague, foggy pie in the sky in the sweet by and by being like Christ. And the reality is not like that at all. The reality is that we do have a self. We are created by God in relationship to God. The only rational stance before God that we can have is humility, but instead we have this made up idealized self-image that needs to go in order so that we can actually begin to live the only real life that we actually have. And I think the way that we have gotten from that way of understanding things to the other fearful way of understanding things, where we want to protect the old Adam, is because we've bought into so much of the secular individualistic self-identity thing, which is a whole collective mythology that we all share in as Americans. I am the individual. Well, you've got to have the idealized self-image in order to sustain that. You know, I mean, it's just, how else are you gonna take your rightful place in the grand pantheon of American heroes as the person that you have an absolute right to have your freedom and all that? That's the American secular religious mythology. It's completely the opposite of what we're being told about the reality of things here, where this idealized self-image is fictitious. Some of them are collective. Remember, we spent a lot of time last week talking about groups that buy into a common vision of a shared idealized image. So that's the kind of thing that we're faced with. Okay, the idealized image must die. Okay, page 158. Now I will uncover, you know, my plot here and let you know that what I am trying to do is there's a point that I want to get to so that we can finish next time. I've gone through and I've picked things out, and I don't think we're missing anything, that we're just trying to pick up the thread of things and move it on. Page 158, the idealized image alienates us from our real self. And again, there's another thing that I think is, and this comes up in the world religions course in Taoism. And there are some ways in which Taoism, certain insights are compatible with Christianity. I don't think that's a problem. I can point to a book written by one of the followers of Seraphim Rose. Seraphim Rose was, he spent a lot of time thinking about Taoism as a young man. And then one of his followers wrote a book called The Tao of Christ, where he points out that Christ is actually the Tao, the way, the path that Taoism is talking about. And there's a lot of truth in that. You know, you have to, you know, be careful. But yeah, there's a lot of truth in that. But what I have in mind is this. And some of you have visited our home. We have this, and above the fireplace, a long scroll, Chinese scroll that I reproduced. And the reason that I like that so much is because there is another scroll that's similar to that at the Metropolitan Museum that makes the point that I want to make here, that I think is so compatible with what we're reading about. And in that scroll, you go to the Metropolitan Museum and you go over to where that scroll is. And this scroll is like, were you there? You've seen it with me, right? It's like, it must be, I don't want to exaggerate. I don't know, I'll be conservative and say 10 yards long. It is a long, long scroll. The emperor of China at one point took a tour through his southern dominions where all those weird-looking mountains are, you know, that I always think of, that's how Paralandra probably would look in Lewis's book. But, you know, there's those weird-shaped mountains, they're limestone mountains all covered with greenery, and he went through that whole area, and the record of his trip was kept on these scrolls, and there's a collection of them. This is one of them, the Metropolitan Museum. But you go all along this particular long section of the scroll, there are no people. In mine, there are lots of people. It's a different scroll. I got it off the internet. But in this one, it always fascinated me because you walk along the scroll looking. This is what we do. You know, we see a picture, we look for ourselves or somebody we're related to. In this picture, there are no people, so you're looking for the people, you know. Looking, you can miss it. You have to go back. Going around this windy road, going up a mountain about a quarter of an inch tall, maybe a little bigger, about a quarter of an inch tall, carrying sticks on his back, is an old man. There's no other people. But, you know, the Taoist would say, human beings have a place in the world. That's it. And I always thought that is the perfect example of the human place in God's creation. Little guy carrying sticks, old guy going up the windy road. Nobody around in any direction. That's our place. Compared to God, compared to the creation that He has made, our place is not the magnificent, fictitious place that we make for ourselves in our own mind, out of our fear of death, out of our alienation from God. We're not doing what we were created and called to do, bring things together and offer them up to God, and the world that we live in becomes communion with Him. Christ has to come and do that for us in the upper room. The human calling to be the priest of creation. He does that for us, and He returns our humanity to us. But one of the things that we have to recognize is that my real self is this point of light in the world that is a human being. And we can only fulfill that particular, you know, and every one of them is different. You know, we're all different. We make that into a clarion call to magnificent individualism. But it really is something about the specific limitedness and particularity of each one of us, that we are that point of that burning coal of live humanity. And we have a place of humility. We don't recognize, if we don't recognize that that is our humble place before God and in God's universe, we can't even live the life that we've been given to live. So the grandiose idealized image that we've come up with, this magnificent, you know, and another thing calls to mind is, and Jimmy will remember this, and the fellow goes up to, on the bus to heaven, mm-hmm. There's a guy up there, he's a big, huge guy, and this little person on the shoulder, and his wife knows that that's the guy. Mm-hmm. His wife doesn't talk to this big, magnificent, well-spoken, impressive figure. She talks to this little, whatever he looks like, I forget, you know, this little kind of almost insect on his shoulder.
He's pulling the strings.
He's pulling the strings of this big puppet. That's the real person. It's like that. It's not that we're being, so yes, we're being asked to give up the idealized image, but we're being asked only to cast off that huge useless puppet. And then we can actually live the life that is ours. I mean, we only have, I've used 70 years already. How many have I got left? What a waste. You know, you spend all this time, you know, and I can think back, I can see, I mean, I've used every technique in this book at one time or another, or in various combinations. Knock one down and you start to put it back together again. So, it's a matter of, you know, coming out of this condition of delusion. This idealized image alienates the person from himself. It puts a person into contact with an imaginary self. a fictitious self. And now I have a note here to myself to go to page 162. Page 162. We want to be Christians, but without dying on Christ's cross. Okay, save my idealized image. That's what we want. Redeem my idealized image. I mean, there's a reality, there's a life there to be lived, and we don't want that. It's not grand enough. We suffer all these things, bottom of 162, because we don't want to be crucified with Christ. Top of 103, this page has got red circle around the page number, and so does the next one, so they're really important. Line 2, page 163. We want to be Christians, but without dying together with Christ in order to proceed to the resurrection. Christ only came and died so that we could arise with him. So that we could, I mean, death was our problem, not his problem. He came, he died in order to unite himself to us so that he could lead us out of death. And we have to die in order to arise and live the life of salvation. Beginning now, remember Orthodox inaugurated eschatology. We believe the end times begin now. Our salvation begins now and continues. We didn't come up with this clever remolding of the Christian story that is believed in the West that to be Christianity, which it actually isn't. And that idea is that, well, there was a legal problem between us and God. We were damned. Christ came. He paid the price. And now all you have to do is accept it. And you are saved. And guess what? Then you get to take your idealized image and go out and live in a secular world and eat, drink, and be merry because you're saved. Clever. If that's your condition, you will never recognize the fact that there is a life that God has saved for you to be able to start living now. But the price is, the cost is this idealized image. I think that makes completely sense. That's almost worth the price of the book. We want to be Christians, but without dying. We want to be Christians and at the same time to be as we came out from Adam. That is a fascinating phrase to me. We want to be as we came out from Adam. You know, there's a big controversy about evolution. And Western Christians are very head up on how we have to reject evolution. Because why? Because we are God created us in the beginning. We are all descended from Adam, not from monkeys. Guess what? Irrelevant. The whole business, the whole controversy, completely irrelevant. Why? Because we are descended from the new Adam, Christ. If we were only descended from the old Adam, and this is what we want. We want to be as we came out from Adam. We want to be able to live a fallen life in a secular world and be saved and have our idealized image. Hey, talk about having your cake and eating it too. That's it. That's what Christianity's all about, right? Having your cake and eating it too. God came into the world in order to make that possible for us. Salvation is not even on that table as we understand it. Am I clear? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the way it is. You know, that's Lies Walter Cronkite used to say many years ago. Okay, we want to be Christians and at the same time to be as we came out from Adam. Save me and my idealized image. That doesn't work. We should stop being children of Adam. From now on, let us be children of Christ. And one becomes a child of Christ when he dies in relation to his former condition. For the idealized image to be put to death isn't something easy. One must be able, because there's that fear, you know, all that fear. One must be able to understand where he started out from, where the creation of this idealized image began. And if we think matters over, examine them closely, we'll see that perhaps it began already in our childhood years, either because our parents or our priests didn't pay attention to us, or because society is the way it is. And so we don't want to live in the midst of a genuine Christian environment, or because the evil one is keeping watch within us, or for other reasons. Since our childhood, one person in this way and another in that way, we avoid this death. This death of the idealized image is brought about in baptism. But in baptism, something can happen that's analogous, that's comparable, with what happens when a tree is grafted. The wild tree that's grafted can become domesticated, a new tree. But if one leaves it alone, the wild tree can revive from the old root. A bunch of shoots can sprout out from it. And the graft, the little domesticated twig that was placed to graft the tree, barely survives. This is a condition that most of us are in. In a similar way, if a Christian doesn't live in conformity with baptism, he'll be as if he didn't die along with Christ during his baptism, and the old man will be revived. One needs then, by a return, by repentance, by humility, by all the other means, and by the mysteries of the sacraments, to die as the old man and to die continuously, to live continuously. More death of the old man, more growth of the new man. And to live continuously. If we do this, we'll feel pain just once, and it'll be over. But if we don't do it this way, and we avoid this death, or permit what should be dead within us to revive, then we'll be in pain continuously. We'll suffer continuously. Unsolvable problems. Unsolvable problems will be created continuously without any progress. While when one identifies himself with Christ, when he's crucified with Christ and suffers together with Christ, he suffers once, he dies once, he's crucified together with Christ one time but forever, that is, for his whole life. And certainly a person doesn't become a saint immediately, doesn't reach the end of the path immediately, doesn't become immediately what the Lord told us. You must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. But he's on the path, today a little, tomorrow some more, the next day a little more, and he makes progress. Idealized image makes that impossible. Okay. Now he's going to wrap up this section. Top of page 165. We have already come to believe in Christ. We have already come to know him. Let's undertake a re-examination, another look at things, in order to find the correct path. So many, way ahead of us, have truly taken the path and reached the end, while for us, we're at the point of being ashamed. We recognize that we've not been living this path of life because we're so discouraged. We're near the point of changing our minds about being Christians. It's not working for me, this Orthodox Christianity. It's too hard. I've heard this. It's hard being Orthodox. Well, you know, straining against the goad, right? Kicking against the goad. Yeah, it's hard. It's not like there's an easier way. Go over to the other church, the easy church. I mean, it's okay. They have the idealized image for you over there, but no reality. We're near the point of beginning to doubt internally. Could it be that we've been led astray? Maybe this Orthodox Christianity is all a bunch of baloney. This is too difficult. Could it be that others have the truth? Maybe we just go and believe some easy church that makes us feel better about ourselves. Maybe they're doing better. This is frightful. I think I'm not far off the mark when I say this and emphasize it. Maybe we continue going to church, but we're not really examining ourselves. We're not really questioning this idealized image. We have some kind of solution that makes things comfortable, and things just stay the way they are. He's describing the fear that we've gone down a path where there is no way of getting through. We're just not good enough. And none of us is. If we rely on ourselves, we are not going to be able to be successful as Christians. And so this self-doubt, it's a good thing. But the self-doubt needs to be that crisis where we recognize the made-up character of what we're relying on. When it comes to fear, Elder Simeon points out, the church isn't afraid. A Christian shouldn't be afraid. If the church as a whole and Christians, each of us separately, live the cross of Christ and have within us this life that Christ gives to each one of us who dies together with him, and if we have nothing else, no idealized image to fall back on, neither shall we worry or complain or weep about it Nor should we change our minds about following Christ. The fact is that we have something within us that others don't have, others trying to make their way in the world without Christ. These others will see that we have it, and this will be the witness that we'll give to the contemporary world as the church. Witness. It is possible to actually live this Christian life, because each one of us is created by God, and Christ came into the world in order to make it possible for us to live that life. And whoever of those happens to be of good disposition and good intention will believe and will themselves become followers of Christ. Whoever wants to believe will believe. The ones who don't want to, don't. It's a spiritual choice. And I don't mean believe in terms of believing a set of doctrines or teachings or proposals. I mean believing in Christ rather than believing in your idealized image and love of the world. It's that kind of belief. Faithfulness to Christ or to the world. Whoever wants to believe will believe. Christ hasn't brought anyone to his side by violence. And then he makes the final point as far as our evangelical witness, which we can only make by living this Christian life. He says it like this: who are we to bring others in that way? By violence. We cannot go out and try to persuade people to be Orthodox Christians. Because when we're doing that, we're indulging ourselves in some kind of building up of our own idealized self-image and presenting that to them. The only way, and this is why Orthodox don't proselytize, you either live the life and be a witness or the church dies in that place. Because we don't have anything else. We have the real life. If we don't have that, we don't have anything. It's not about promulgating a set of doctrine and teaching so we all get together and then what? Then we have a shared, idealized self-image. Hey, it can make us feel really great. And who among us have died in the way that Elder Simeon is saying? This is what Christianity is about. This is the only place that salvation lies. Trying to propagandize others into thinking Orthodox, you know, you're creating an Orthodox denomination where people believe in ideas. That's not evangelizing. The Orthodox way of evangelizing is that we all together make this struggle, this effort to dispense with our love of ourselves bit by bit, not all at once. He says, yes, it's possible. There have been saints who've done it once and done. It's over. No more suffering. Yes, that can happen. But for most of us, we're going to be a little more reluctant than that. So it's going to take the rest of our lives. Now, somebody who is a saint, he or she, they spend the rest of their lives being a living witness to others. But most of us, we spend our whole lives kind of, hedging our bets with the idealized self-image. Yeah, I believe it, I know it's really true, but I'm afraid and just kind of halfway. So we do it a little bit. Earlier in the book, he mentions, and we've mentioned in other books, we've seen it mentioned, that even doing a little, even a little doubt in your faith in the idealized self-image and recognition, I know secretly this isn't it, that makes a difference. That is already a move toward Christ.
I don't know how we could get all the way through a discussion of this book, especially 10 years ago, without the movie The Matrix coming up there, where people are living in this dream where they're, you know, whatever image they have of themselves, and then they come out of it. It's much more difficult to live that way, but real, you know. We knew at that time this was something really important and mattered somehow. I don't know where they got the idea from, but I don't know. You may know.
They got it from a postmodern philosopher who's mentioned in the book. I'm trying to remember his name. He's in my history of philosophy course.
There's something we recognize about the truth of this already, that we kind of live in a self-deluded way. You know, even the people who are
not Christian,
yeah.
Living.
But this, you know, I think maybe the difference there would be who are we really? And they have, you know, maybe a better self-idealized image behind that.
The good news is that we are at least somebody.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a lot, you know, There was a point in my conversion where I was pretty sure there's nobody there. It was a low point.
Well, there's something.
But there is somebody. There is somebody. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, but it, but. Maybe yeah, that was a bad, that was a bad spot.
So how did you get through that, Father?
Well.
That's not a short answer, probably.
I went to seminary.
Well, I mean, I know that I'm constantly coming up against things where I realize, oh, you know. And sometimes it's things that, you know, I haven't done in a while or something, and between the time I did this thing the last time, and my heart or my mind has changed in some way or the other, that I realize, you know, I don't enjoy doing that anymore, or that's not, and why? Well, it could have to do with, you know, lots of different things. Ideally, it would be because I've been going to confession. There's some repentance that's happened, and I see things better. It could be that I'm just older, you know, and everything looks different because of that. But there's a kind of a sense, for me at least, at this 50-plus place, of a sense of sort of like he was talking about jumping out of the airplane. But not jumping, more of being pushed. You know, here I am out of the airplane. And that's kind of the secret. You either are going to jump or you're going to be pushed. You're coming out of the airplane. You're coming out. And so we come out of the airplane and then we either accept the reality or we don't. You know, but I suppose. But there's a sense of free-floating, a sense of, you know. For instance, a specific example of this happened to me that I haven't recovered from when my oldest child left the house. I wasn't even aware that this had happened inside of me, but all of my, it seemed like I didn't care if I got up or not for a while. I just had to use discipline to make, because the things I realized that many of my actions and the things I was doing was because he was coming. Well, he had already come and gone now, you know, in a certain sense. But, you know, trying to make sure that I was doing all the things I needed to take care of, having family and kids and all. And then there was something, even though there were still four children left, there was something iconic about him leaving that changed inside me after he left. And probably Father Jacob, maybe Matush can understand a little of what I'm saying, and nobody else has any idea what I'm talking about. But there's something that happened there inside me that it was like a shift in the world, shift in the horizon, the line. And, you know, and since then, a whole bunch of those have happened. And you've been here for all of them. So
I felt that way when my dad died. It was like the world had no meaning anymore. What was...
I remember when I got your telephone call. I was at work and you called. And you said, my daddy died. And I heard your voice as a child.
So, you know. Yeah, but it was like there was no reason to go on.
Right, there's some of that that was going on inside of me. It took me a while to identify. It was more of a sense. It wasn't a thought process that I was not a conscious thought process. There were words attached to it. Just a realization that, everything's changed. All the colors look different. The whole world has shifted somehow. And what's different now? And you know, as I'm learning, life's going to keep doing that.
Yeah.
You know, in these other ways, in bigger ways, in smaller ways, in different ways, kind of consistently. You know, that is going to change things. And it's life seems to have this sort of built-in humbling process if we will try to pay attention to it. I guess ideally we would get ahead of it and humble ourselves. You know,
that way you get to live the rest of your life in a different condition. That's, I think, at least headed in along the saint's path, anyway.
Right. Well.
Or there's always rebellion.
Yeah.
Beethoven died with his fist in the air.
But he still died.
Yeah, it's true, but he was Beethoven.
You know, the thing is,
it's like suicide.
That's exactly right.
I refuse to accept it in any other way.
The thing is, the moment after the suicide's over, we haven't been on that side, but I imagine all of a sudden there's reality starkly before you, and I don't know. I said that just to say, I think that I know what he's talking about. And, to some degree, at least, you know. Because I understand the part about having an image that is obviously flawed because things keep shifting and changing. But I'm not sure the other part, the other side, who, okay, I'm not that person. So, yourself?
I will adjust it.
So who am I? I mean, but is it this adjusted version of, and then there's kind of a really kind of pathetic sense of trying to get back to whatever it was I thought I was trying to get to.
Sure, sure.
You know, that we
I really like that. I mean, I don't like to leave a thread behind. I want all of the threads from the past together. We reweave them somehow. That's just my nature. That's the way I think. That's the way I live. So, but every once in a while, you realize you're not even holding a thread.
Well, there's a handful of threads and they're broken on the other end. What am I going to do with these?
Yeah.
Holding something.
I thought there were threads.
Well, have mercy. What do you think, Stephen? What's your experience of this? Or may I ask?
Well, I don't. I know when my dad died, I was like, I was always trying to prove myself to him. So, you know, now I don't have anyone to prove myself to or something, you know.
Yeah.
It was like,
yeah.
You know.
I think it's probably a good description.
See, Dad, yeah, I can do it.
Yeah, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of hard. It's just like, now who do I prove myself to? I mean, but so go ahead and write some poems down and try to prove yourself to everybody.
Good idea.
Write a few poems and prove to everybody that you can do something that they might actually think is kind of all right.
What do you think of Scott Carnes? Did you?
Oh, I've been reading the one that I got from Johnny and Rebecca,
right.
the red book.
Yeah,
I'm about halfway through it, and what I can understand, I find interesting, but there's a lot that I'm like, I know there's got to be a lot there that I'm just not seeing.
It's not all on the surface.
No, it's not.
It's not just this rhymes and it's out there on the surface. It's not.
He's the real deal.
Yeah.
He's one of the I think their greatest living poets, especially in when it comes to spiritual poetry, religious poetry,
yeah.
And that's not just Orthodox who think that. It's Joan Didion, who is a famous essayist, you know, would agree with that.
Yeah.
And she's not, I don't know if she's even Christian, but if she is, she's not Orthodox, that's for sure. But nobody can do what he does with language when it comes to spiritual realities, spiritual life. He's the best. And he seems like he's a nice guy. You know, I mean, approachable. I could imagine spending some time with him. I mean, he has that book about going to Mount Athos. I'd love to go with him, you know.
It was his book that I think put me over the edge, if you will, because his book's called A Short Trip to the Edge. But his book put me over the edge to really wanting to go, you know, and I started asking Father Marcus about it because he'd been a few times.
And the way he described it is just the way it is.
Right, yeah. That's right.
He's a poet. He can capture reality.
Yeah.
Like no other kind of writer can.
The Chestnut Forest is what I think of, because he mentioned the Chestnut Forest. And I thought, what is that? And we rode through Chestnut Forest on the way to Vado Petty. I know, yeah, you weren't noticing that, but I was, because I read the book, and I was looking at the tree types. Where are the chestnut
forests? I wasn't noticing anything.
You weren't?
I was alive.
Yeah. It was, and he talked about the impossibly blue water. And it was impossibly blue. You can't blue
it
water.
It is incredible.
And you can see through it.
The color of the water is incredible.
Yeah.
It's just the color of the water is worth the trip, the price of the admission.
It just about is.
Just to see that.
You know, and the wake that's so white against the water. Incredible.
Right.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And next time, 167.